Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hobrock. First on this week's program, Fountain Hills officials punished a paper for coverage they don't like. This story was written by T.J. LaHerou and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on May 30th. A few months ago, President Donald Trump created a First Amendment firestorm by barring the Associated Press from certain events because the outlet declined to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. In Arizona, a similarly petty battle is playing out over the freedom of the press. In the valley town of Fountain Hills, a right-wing contingent of the town council removed a press table, primarily used by the local Fountain Hills Times Independent newspaper, because those council members did not like the tone of the paper's coverage. The paper can still cover town council meetings, but must sit among the crowd. The reason for the change was revealed in an op-ed from council member Brenda Kalavianakis, which, fittingly, appeared in the Times Independent. After noticing the table had been removed during a May 6th council meeting, Kalavianakis filed a public records request for emails about the decision. Those emails revealed that at least two council members explicitly tied the table's removal to their dislike of the paper's coverage. Frankly, I am fed up with the Times' partisan reporting and think it is time to remove the corner reporter's table, Councilmember Rick Watts wrote in one email. If the Times personnel cannot act and report in a factual, nonpartisan manner without resorting to sensational headlines, reporting on the council and various commissions without obvious bias, then I see no reason for providing any special seating accommodations. An email from Fountain Hills Vice Mayor Hannah Larrabee echoed Watts' disdain for the local press. I'd like to suggest we remove the media table from the council chambers, Larrabee wrote. The Fountain Hills Times Independent, especially since the change of ownership, has consistently misquoted the council, reported on items while only seeking statements from one side of the aisle, and on several occasions reported on my job without researching or seeking to understand what I do there. Watson Larrabee did not respond to a request for comment from Phoenix New Times, including about which stories published by the Times Independent had sensational headlines or showed obvious bias. A quick scroll through news headlines for the outlet didn't reveal any that are particularly sensational. Ryan Winslet, managing editor at the paper's chain Independent News Media, said the company's president and editor-in-chief were both on vacation and could not provide a comment until Monday. Attack on the press. Kalavianakis first noticed the press table was gone during a May 6th council meeting, asking town manager Rachel Goodwin if it was broken and when it would return. There was a discussion and a directive from the mayor and several other council members with the request to remove the table from the space, Goodwin responded. Given that this is the council's chambers, the mayor and council has that prerogative. Councilmember Peggy McMahon chimed in to ask that the issue be put on a meeting agenda, because I wasn't asked about the decision to remove the table. She was shot down because she wasn't called on to speak. But Kalavianakis continued pressing the issue, addressing Mayor Jerry Friedle. This is the first I've heard of it, and I am on this council, she said. Mr. Mayor, would you like to comment on that? Friedle responded that the item was not on the agenda and did not comment on the table's removal. Kalavianakis and McMahon asked for it to be put on the agenda in the future, but it was not discussed at the next meeting on May 20th. New Times asked Friedle whether the outlet's coverage was the reason he and other council members killed the press table. You have answered your own question and have the emails to support the answer, he responded. First Amendment experts consulted by New Times agreed the move is an unflattering look for the council. It's always bad when you see a public official doing something to punish the press for their coverage, said Greg Leslie, the executive director of the First Amendment Clinic at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. It's wrong. Seth Stern, the director of advocacy at Freedom of the Press Foundation, called retaliation illegal. It's very much unconstitutional for the government to in any way punish the press over its editorial or content decisions, Stern said. However, Leslie wondered whether the move was enough grounds for a lawsuit. The AP successfully sued over its exclusion from covering certain Trump events, but Leslie said the press table issue might not be worth bringing a lawsuit over because there's not much provable damage and cities are not obligated to maintain a press table. Stern acknowledged that the press isn't entitled to have its own table, but said the reason for removing it is more important in light of the First Amendment. If the paper has its own desk, that desk cannot be taken away in retaliation for its constitutionally protected reporting, whether the government likes it at all, Stern said. It's the same thing we're seeing at the federal level. Residents upset. The move has upset more than just First Amendment experts. Several Fountain Hills residents told New Times they are angered by the removal of the press table. Resident Don Scott called the Times Independence coverage completely unbiased and rejected the notion that the paper's work is slanted. They do a fantastic job, and I'm a former journalist going back years, Scott said. He called the decision to remove the press table outrageous, petty, and part and parcel of the bigger picture of what's going on in town. Another resident, Cindy Couture, criticized the move in her own Times Independent op-ed on May 8th, 2 days after the table was removed. The action appears to be part of our town MAGA whisper campaign to shut down the town paper, she wrote. Think what our town would be without it. Just a mess of Facebook misinformation. Farrell Pales, a 22-year resident of Fountain Hills, told New Times that the Times Independent has reported on some events that reflect really poorly on the council, though the council's retaliation casts it in an even worse light. It's really hard for me to characterize it in any other way than shades of fascism, she said. I think they mean to trample any critiques of what they're doing. I think they mean to govern non-transparently, even though Mayor Friedel campaigned on being transparent. In her op-ed, Kalavianakis said the removal of the press table highlights disregard for transparency by our local officials. Punitive measures are meant to control, influence, and silence news coverage and criticism by concerned private citizens, she continued. Retaliation inherently has a chilling effect, making journalists and citizens hesitant to investigate controversial topics or criticize those in power. If journalists are reluctant to report on sensitive topics, the people regrettably pay the price. For Stern, that's the upshot. The press table dust-up might seem like a small-town squabble, but it's a canary in a big and crumbling coal mine. Although this might seem minor and petty because the press can still report, it usually starts out minor and petty before it escalates, Stern said. And where a government is allowed to get away with that first step because everyone brushes it off, that sends them the message that they can get away with more. Next, a story written by Stephen Lemons and posted on May 28th. A septic tank in this tiny Arizona town could crack a 2006 cold case. It's not hard to miss the small Arizona outpost of Seligman. It's a dot on the map about an hour west of Flagstaff. Technically not a town, but a census-designated place. A more complicated way of saying, this place exists. Home to roughly 450 souls, its only claim to fame is that it sits on historic Route 66, though it clings to only one of that famous highway's 2,448 miles. A passing motorist could inhale upon entering Seligman and not have to let out a breath before rolling out the other end. It's also not hard to go missing in Seligman. That's what happened to Phoenix native Keith King just more than 19 years ago. On May 7th, 2006, according to one account, the 46-year-old walked away from his girlfriend's house in a t-shirt and flip-flops. He plodded over the windswept rocky terrain, dotted with pinyon and juniper trees, for a hike. Then, he was never seen again. It was as if he'd been beamed up by one of the extraterrestrials he believed in, and sometimes believed himself to be. A missing persons case was opened, and inquiries were made, but the mystery of King's disappearance has remained unsolved. But it certainly has not remained undiscussed. Seligman has a population of a small high school and can be every bit as gossipy. Theories abound. King's girlfriend, Karen Wells, was hardly a monogamist, and King was not the only beau in her life. Some of Wells' other suitors had wives. In a tiny town, one wouldn't have to dig very deep to strike upon lingering resentment. Perhaps someone got jealous and then got violent. Perhaps, instead of disappearing, King was disappeared. For much of the last two decades, theories were all they were. Wells died in 2023, leaving only her official account with the Yavapai County Sheriff's Office to go by. One popular suspect, another of Wells' flames, a man whose wife had warned authorities about him, took whatever he knew to the grave earlier this year. The pool of suspects and potential witnesses was already small in Seligman. The passing years have drained it further. However, one person is not content to let King's disappearance fade into the past. King's youngest daughter, Lindsay King, has resolved to uncover her dad's fate. In 2021, a private investigator named Kelly Waldrop began frequenting the bar at the Phoenix restaurant, The Main Ingredient, where Lindsay worked at the time. He was simply seeking a watering hole, not a job. But King's daughter convinced him to take up her father's case. Waldrop began poking around, tugging on threads that had been untouched for years, and unearthing new ones. Over a series of months, an alternate theory of what happened to Keith King began to form. Lindsay King and Waldrop now think that he's solved the case. They believe Keith King was murdered, and they believe they know who killed him and why. And perhaps most importantly to proving all this, they believe they know where his body is, chopped into pieces and stuffed into a septic tank that's buried on a property in Seligman. All they need, they say, is for the county sheriff's office to dig it up. Luminous beings. Lindsay King was 18 when her father disappeared. Sitting in shorts and a t-shirt in her central Phoenix bungalow one recent spring day, her large brown eyes occasionally teared up while talking about her dad. More than half her life has passed since Keith King vanished. Lindsay is now 37, but her mind turns often to her father. "There hasn't been a day in my life that I haven't thought about my dad," she said. Lindsay's parents divorced when she was six, but her memories of her father are largely positive. For her 9th birthday, he hired a limo to ferry her and her friends to the Great Skate roller rink in Glendale. That same year, she joined him for Bringing Your Daughter to Work Day at Sands Chevrolet, where he was a sales manager. She got to drive a golf cart, almost crashing it into one of the cars on the lot. She remembers him as funny and cool and successful, living in a condo at the Point Hilton, driving a Corvette and riding a Harley. He listened to Jewel and Jimmy Buffett and boasted that he planned to be a millionaire by age 50. In a separate interview, Lindsay's younger brother Riley described Keith as spontaneous. Keith had a pet sugar glider and lavished his youngest son with all the good toys, Riley said. A Nintendo 64, a dirt bike, a BB gun. He was always fun to be around, Riley recalled, but unfortunately, there wasn't enough time to really understand who my dad was. Keith disappeared when Riley was 14. Even before that, though, the dad he knew had begun to slip away. Years before his disappearance, Keith suffered a mental collapse, plagued by delusions and isolating himself from society. One Christmas Eve, Lindsay recalled, he showed up in a trench coat and dark glasses and was obsessed with The Matrix. He gave her a gift and told her it was from the one to the one. A psychiatric evaluation of Keith, performed by West Yavapai Guidance Clinic in 2003 and shared with Phoenix New Times by Lindsay, diagnosed him with psychosis and said Keith would qualify for disability. He'd moved to Prescott from Phoenix and become increasingly solitary, stating that he couldn't mix with people. The psych evaluation was the first time he'd left home in a month. Keith told the evaluator that his life changed one day when he looked through binoculars and saw UFOs and luminous beings that were transparent with a greenish color. He was paranoid that people, including his second wife, were trying to poison him. To avoid illness, he'd drawn a Pac-Man on his hand. The ravenous video character would go through my arm and get all the negativity out of my body. He admitted to abusing cocaine, meth, and alcohol in the past, but told the doctor that he was sober. According to his children, Keith's sobriety was less than constant. Lindsay said her father dabbled with meth all his life. Her aunt, Kelly King, called Keith a lifelong fan of alcohol and drugs. It was through drugs, Lindsay believes, that Keith met Karen Wells. They'd first met in Prescott, but eventually moved to Seligman in 2005, where Keith lived in an RV on a 40-acre property owned by Wells' parents, a few miles south of town. Then, one day, Keith walked out of the RV and, underdressed for the terrain, supposedly lit out for a hike. He was never seen again. At least, that's what Wells claimed. Love Triangle. Not long after Keith went missing, there were hints of a more nefarious fate. The next day, Wells filed a missing person report with the county sheriff's office. She told deputies that she'd last seen Keith the previous morning in his RV in flip-flops, a t-shirt, and gray pants. He was about 170 pounds and 5'10" and wore a mustache. Keith was, quote, psychotic and had refused to take his meds, she told them. He also believed he was an alien. Keith had been reportedly spotted two other times before he vanished, according to the sheriff's office report. At about 5:10 p.m., the day before Keith disappeared, an Arizona Department of Public Safety officer spotted him in a parking lot near his truck, which he had been towing after conking out on a railroad track west of town. A Seligman man named Bill Wilkins told deputies that he'd seen Keith roughly 11 hours later, walking near a Chevron station. Wilkins had given him a ride home. Then, the investigation got weird. Keith and Wilkins had a complicated history. Chris Facilio, a longtime friend of Keith's, told deputies that the two men had been involved in a love triangle with Wells. Wilkins, who was separated from his wife, knew Keith was dating Wells, and vice versa. Wells told sheriff's deputies that King and Wilkins were friends with no issues between them. But Wilkins' estranged wife apparently felt her husband was dangerous. On May 15th, 8 days after Keith went missing, Patty Wilkins came into the sheriff's office substation in Seligman. She'd learned her husband was seeing Wells, she told deputies, and he'd become angry. If Patty disappeared, the sheriff's report says, she wanted to make sure we knew where she lived and that we would not stop looking for her. Holes also began to form in Wells' account. She told deputies she'd retrieved King's wallet from his truck, only to later claim that he left his wallet, cell phone, and checkbook in his RV. Wells, who had done 2 years in prison in the early 2000s for multiple drug violations, also claimed others had seen Keith since he vanished. Those sightings never panned out. Not long after Keith disappeared, a helicopter search was conducted. It turned up nothing. Later, a search and rescue team scoured Seligman and beyond with cadaver-sniffing dogs. No body was found. According to the police report and relatives, the King family tirelessly drove up to Seligman to paper the town with posters and even employed psychics to aid in the search. Those efforts proved futile. In 2009, 3 years after anyone had laid eyes on Keith King, the sheriff's office declared the case closed. Closed it has remained, gathering dust in the files of the county sheriff's cold case unit. Then, 12 years later, a private investigator began frequenting the main ingredient. Enter the Seamus. Kelly Waldrop was just looking for a place to bend his elbow. A Phoenix native, the 72-year-old Waldrop had enjoyed a long and distinguished career in law enforcement. He'd been an investigator for the U.S. Navy's Naval Criminal Investigative Service and had served as an intelligence analyst for the FBI. He then worked as a private dick in Los Angeles for many years before semi-retiring and moving home to Phoenix. Rail thin, with a hangdog look that belies a biting wit, Waldrop has seen it all, doing investigations for NCIS in places like Thailand, Haiti, and Saudi Arabia. He started his career as a cop with the Glendale Police Department, and later became a deputy at the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, where he came to loathe Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Before leaving the Sheriff's Office for NCIS, Waldrop became a whistleblower, alerting the press to the corruption of Arpaio's regime, earning him a permanent place on the sheriff's enemies list. Seeking an alternative to his preferred watering hole, Durant's, Waldrop stumbled upon the bar at the Main Ingredient, where Lindsay managed the restaurant and sometimes filled in as bartender. "I was a regular customer at the Main Ingredient," Waldrop told New Times. "Word got around, probably because I mentioned it, that I was a private investigator. And one night, Lindsay approached me and said, 'Hey, maybe you could find my missing father.'" Lindsay had been haunted by her dad's unknown fate. She learned of his disappearance while a senior in high school, when a cousin told her Keith had been missing for 2 weeks and was presumed dead. Lindsay's family wanted to keep the news from her until after graduation. As an adult, she asked for and received the family's file on the disappearance, waiting for the right bit of information or the right person to crack the case. Waldrop was that person. He craves a challenge and took on the case pro bono. His first move was to obtain the county sheriff's report on the disappearance. King's family also supplied him with information, including notes from another private detective, Jack Locarno, whom the family hired in 2006 out of frustration with the official investigation. Locarno's notes added some shading to the mystery. Vasilio, Keith's good friend, had told the PI that it wasn't unusual for King to take off for weeks at a time without telling anyone. Given that, Vasilio thought Wells was very quick to report Keith missing. Locarno also interviewed Wells and Wilkins at the Seligman discount store where they worked. They acknowledged they'd been seeing each other for several weeks, but Wilkins claimed their relationship was platonic and hinted he was incapable of having sex. Both repeated versions of what they'd told deputies. Locarno later talked to Wilkins' estranged wife. Patty Wilkins said she'd put up missing posters for King, but that Wilkins had told her to remove them because Keith was in touch with his family. Keith was not. Wilkins told Locarno that his wife was mistaken. He told her to take down the posters because no one would recognize Keith from the photo they featured. Locarno came to no conclusion, but according to the sheriff's office report, he told deputies that he believed King died due to suspicious circumstances and that he had a, quote, bad feeling about Wilkins. Waldrop had a similar impression, at least initially. A year ago, he traveled to Seligman to speak with Wilkins. In his report, which he shared with New Times, he described Wilkins as hostile and said his recollections relating to Keith's disappearance were contradictory. But that might be explained by Wilkins' dementia, a condition his daughter confirmed to New Times. Wilkins died earlier this year at 81. Patty Wilkins is still alive, but not well enough to be interviewed, her daughter said. Wells is also dead, having succumbed in 2003 to emphysema, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and pneumonia. But Waldrop spoke with her daughter, Brenda Lindsay, by phone. She remembered Keith, she said, who her mother told her had, quote, just disappeared. Later that same day, Brenda called again. Crying, she claimed she had just learned the truth. But she couldn't speak freely in Seligman, she said. Waldrop made plans to meet her in Phoenix. Septic tank sayonara. Sitting in Waldrop's apartment days later, Brenda served up the first new lead the case had seen in years. After first speaking to Waldrop on the phone, she told a longtime friend of her mother's that a private detective was sniffing around. The woman suddenly asked if Keith's body had been found. The woman then told Brenda about a tearful, out-of-the-blue confession Wells had made to her while they watched TV one night in the months leading up to Wells' death. The woman later repeated the story to Waldrop. Wells allegedly confessed the following to her friend. The night before Keith disappeared, Wells was in her home south of town when she began arguing with yet another boyfriend, a married man, but not Wilkins. Keith heard the commotion and walked from his RV into the ruckus. Keith threatened to out the man to his wife and then turned to leave. The man then shot Keith in the back, killing him. He then forced Wells to help him chop up Keith's body and dispose of it in a septic tank on the property. New Times interviewed Wells' friend, who asked not to be named out of fear for her safety. She claimed Wells had sworn her to secrecy until after her death. Wells maintained a relationship with Keith's alleged killer, the friend said, but was, quote, scared of him. The friend claimed to have once heard Wells and this man arguing about money, with Wells threatening to expose their relationship to his wife. asked if she would repeat her story to the police. The woman said she didn't know. She didn't want the man, quote, coming after me, chopping me up. Brenda was also aware of her mother's affair with the man. My mom really had a thing for married guys there for a while, she told New Times. She knew her mom was afraid. Wells had knives in her trailer in case she had to defend herself. And Brenda believed she harbored a dark secret. I do remember very vividly her telling me, "You have no idea about the nightmares that I have," Brenda said. "You have no idea about the things I'm trying to deal with inside my head." Unlike most of her mom's boyfriends, Brenda liked Keith. A little crazy, but not in a bad way, she recalled. He was definitely the best boyfriend that my mom ever had. She's bonded with Keith's daughter, passing along information about their respective parents. But since hearing of her mom's alleged confession, she believes she and Lindsay King have more in common than they'd prefer. Brenda now suspects foul play in her mom's death. Wells died 2 hours after returning from a 5-day stint in the hospital, she said, and she didn't seem ready to die. Shortly before she passed, she texted 911 to her daughter, who lived in the trailer next door. By the time Brenda saw it and checked on her, Wells was dead. The county didn't perform an autopsy, and Brenda didn't have the money to pay for one. Wells was cremated. Brenda now wonders if her mother was silenced. Wells had always left her trailer unlocked. When asked about her willingness to go on the record with her suspicions, Brenda offered New Times a warning. "If I disappear," she said, "it's not because I wanted to." Desert Dumping Ground. New Times contacted the man at the center of Wells' confession. Because he has not officially been accused of wrongdoing in what is still considered to be a missing persons case, New Times is not revealing his name. Garrulous and amiable, the Yavapai County man spoke to New Times in person for more than an hour. The rambling interview covered a wide range of topics, including true crime television shows, classic cars, and serial killers. Shown a photo of King and Wells together, he said he wouldn't know King, quote, "if he stepped on my toe," though he admitted that he was familiar with Wells and with Bill Wilkins and knew the pair had dated. Asked about speculation that Wells and Wilkins may have had something to do with King's disappearance, he was doubtful. "She didn't seem like that kind of person," he said. "And Bill, I certainly didn't think he was going to kill someone over her. But you never freaking know." He did agree that the circumstances of King's disappearance, as related by New Times, sounded, quote, "suspicious." "If he went on a hike and died, somebody would find him," he said. "That doesn't make sense. You just walk out there and disappear." The man denied having anything to do with King's disappearance. He said that he and Wells had been just friends, though text messages obtained by New Times may suggest otherwise. Those messages come from Wells' iPhone and laptop. Dated from 2020 to 2023, many years after Keith disappeared, they only hint at a relationship and its nature. The man wrote that a photo of Wells at the Black Cat Bar was, quote, "hot." She called him honey. She complained about her health and money, and he sometimes offered to help financially. They discussed meeting each other. Wells sometimes got angry with him. "I'm not going to be in the middle of someone else's relationship," Wells once texted the man. "I deserve better. If you are unhappy, change your life." "I'll talk to you tomorrow," the man wrote back stoically. Brenda said that after she spoke to Waldrop, she got a call from someone at the sheriff's office asking if she could bring her mom's devices to its headquarters in Prescott. She didn't have a working car, so they asked her to drop them off at the Seligman substation. She balked. Seligman is such a small town, an act of flatulence is like the shot heard around the world. There's no way I would drop off anything that I wanted to have taken serious to the cops up there, she said. I just wouldn't do it, because it's all about who you know and who you are. Instead, Brenda gave the devices to Keith's daughter, who shared them with New Times. Waldrop said he sent his reports of what he'd uncovered, including the tale of the septic tank and the news that Brenda had Wells' devices, to the Yavapai County Sheriff's Office. They seemed to garner little interest until he wrote directly to Sheriff David Rhodes about the case. In 2024, he said, he met with volunteer investigator Teresa Higdon and Detective Sergeant Charles Owens, her supervisor. Waldrop said Owens was defensive and explained how difficult it would be to remove a septic tank from the property where Keith was last seen. Higdon and Owens also met with Lindsay King earlier this year. Owens assured her that her dad's case was on the front burner and said Waldrop had brought up some good points. The case had been in disarray, he noted, but the investigation was again moving forward. In an interview with New Times, Higdon said the sheriff's office welcomed Waldrop's research, but was still trying to validate it. Officially, the investigation is still a missing persons case, not a homicide inquiry. Higdon complained that the cold case unit is often hampered by the fact that Yavapai County is a well-known dumping ground for the corpses of victims murdered elsewhere. She said the King case is one of 50 to 75 currently being worked by her unit. She said she was aware of the septic tank theories, but she did not say whether the sheriff's office had plans to dig one up. The haunting. Those septic tanks may hold the key to finding Keith or what's left of him. According to documents on file with the Yavapai County Recorder's Office, Wells' parents sold the property that holds them in 2023. On a recent visit to Seligman by New Times, Brenda pointed to the area behind the house where Keith had parked his RV. There were two septic tanks on the property, one for the house and one for a dilapidated mobile home out front. Jacob Stelius now owns the property. He confirmed that there were two septic tanks on the property, only one of which had been pumped. He told New Times that he granted sheriff's deputies access to his property 5 or 6 months back, but nothing came of it. Lindsay King said that in her meeting with Owens last year, the sergeant said that in order to obtain a warrant to unearth the septic tanks, he first needed to develop probable cause. Speaking recently by phone to New Times, Owens declined to comment on the status of the investigation. As for the septic tanks, he said digging them up could connect the dots or reveal nothing, even if Keith's body was actually dumped in them 19 years ago. In my experience, most of the flesh would be gone, Owens said. But depending on the chemicals and the things inside the septic tank, we could expect to possibly recover bone material or bone fragment material and be able to analyze that. The cold case unit that Owens oversees has scored some successes, cracking two unsolved murders in and near Prescott. In 2023, the unit reportedly helped solve the 1987 murder of 23-year-old college student Kathy Splosito. And in 2020, a cold case volunteer helped solve the 1980 shooting death of Michael E. Lee outside of town. Owens acknowledged the King family's frustrations and asked for patience. Cold cases are difficult to investigate, he said. People get older, they forget minor details, and in a cold case, it's the minor details that point us into the direction of where to go, he said. In Keith's case, several principals are dead. But Lindsay King remained skeptical. In a follow-up interview on the patio of The Main Ingredient, Lindsay said she found Higdon and Owens to be trustworthy, but felt they were giving her conflicting messages. They asked her to be patient, while harping on how complicated and expensive it would be to dig up a septic tank. "We're not going to go into this until we have a smoking gun," is how they were trying to present it to me, she said. "I don't feel they're doing anything more than has been done before." She wants more giddy up and go from the sheriff's office, particularly when it comes to the tanks she's convinced hold her father's remains. The issue is not a new one. Though the sheriff's office has been responsive of late, the King family has long complained about the office's lack of interest in the case. In a 2007 letter to an attorney, Linda King, Lindsay's grandmother and Keith's mom, detailed a series of perceived missteps and displays of indifference on the part of the sheriff's office, concluding that its investigators didn't care because Keith had been a drug addict from time to time. Lindsay made the letter available to New Times. An ordained minister in the Church of Science of the Mind, Linda King died in 2019 at age 81. She never learned the fate of her son Keith, the fourth of her six children. Keith's ghost doesn't just haunt the King family. Employees at the Seligman Outposts, the Black Cat Bar, and the Roadkill Cafe recalled seeing Keith and Wells together and the missing persons posters the family put up when Keith vanished. One waitress told New Times that after Keith disappeared, Wells and Wilkins were seen together and tongues wagged, suggesting the pair had offed him. Lindsay said that initially her main goal in partnership with Waldrop was to find out what happened to her father and possibly recover his remains. Ideally, she'd like the sheriff's office to pump the septic tanks, do a criminal investigation, and seek the prosecution of her dad's killer. But she knows that justice is elusive and that she may never be able to prove who murdered her dad. Still, she wants to send a broader message to the person or persons who may have taken her father's life, that he was not garbage, and that he's been sorely missed. I want the person who killed my father to know that he had kids, and that his life was valuable, and it meant something to me, she said. It felt like he was just thrown away or something. My dad deserved a lot better than that. I want people to know he was loved. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on On Demand Podcasts. Scroll down to the program you're interested in and click on Listen. Here's a story written by T.J. LeHeru and posted on May 29th. 3 years after cops let her son drown, Tempe woman demands city do more. On Wednesday, dozens of people gathered near Tempe Town Lake to mark a somber anniversary. 3 years earlier, 34-year-old unhoused Tempe resident Sean Bickings drowned in the lake. Two Tempe police officers stood by and watched, unwilling to go into the water and unequipped with the proper tools or training to intervene. Bickings' death made national headlines. The scandal forced Tempe to make some safety changes, including the installation of flotation rings around the lake. But at a Wednesday memorial for Bickings, his friends and family, including his mother, Tori Toro, criticized Tempe officials for for not making more changes to improve safety at the lake. Others have drowned in the lake since Bicking's death. 3 years after Sean Bicking's tragic death, the city of Tempe and the Tempe police still have not added enough safety precautions to Tempe Town Lake, said Benjamin Taylor, a lawyer who is representing Toro in a wrongful death lawsuit against the city, in a statement to New Times. Other people have fallen in the lake and drowned since Sean Bicking's death. We need to see more improvements to minimize the incidents at the lake. In a statement, Tempe spokesperson Chris Baxter-Ging said the city sympathizes with those who mourn the loss of Sean Bicking's, and that it has added improved water safety measures and new procedures. Those include the dozens of flotation rings and having park rangers patrol the lake. But many people at the Wednesday gathering doubted the efficacy of those measures, particularly the flotation rings. There's not enough for one thing, Toro said. They're too far apart, and if anybody pulls one out, it doesn't notify the fire department or the police department at all. To me, they're just like a decoration. In 2023, Toro filed a wrongful death and negligence lawsuit against Tempe, seeking $3 million for emotional damages. That lawsuit is ongoing, and a Maricopa County Superior Court judge rejected a city motion to dismiss it last year. The Tempe City Council discussed the lawsuit with council in an executive session on May 20th, and Baxter-Ging declined to comment on the lawsuit. The drowning. Memorial attendees described Bicking's as generous and caring, someone who was concerned for the unhoused long before he joined their ranks. He and Toro moved to the valley from Utah when he was young, and seeing unhoused people was a novel experience for him. On trips to McDonald's, he'd want to help. He'd say, "Mom, what about that guy right there?" Toro said. So I'd say, "What do you want to do? Do you want to get something for yourself or for somebody else?" And that's what he would choose, somebody else. For more than a decade leading up to his death, Bicking's lived on the streets. Tempe resident Kush Patel, who got to know Bicking's when Patel was a student at Arizona State University, said Bicking's would give you the shirt off his back, and I've seen him do it. Ben Jeffrey, a formerly unhoused military veteran who has since become one of the Valley's foremost advocates for the homeless, said Bicking's was important to many people. "We all consider him like a best friend," Jeffrey said. "That's the thing, all of us. Just like not one or two people, but everybody." 2 days before Bicking's drowned, he and other unhoused people met with Tempe officials, including Mayor Corey Woods, about a plan to let unhoused people quash their misdemeanor warrants if they are willing to receive social service assistance. 48 hours later, an outstanding warrant was the reason Bicking's went into the water. Bicking's and his partner, Susan Smith, were confronted by police about a domestic violence allegation. Both denied that any violence had taken place and said that they were just arguing. Police decided to check to see if there were outstanding warrants for Bicking's, who hopped the fence and sat for a few minutes before jumping into the lake at 5:12 a.m. "I believe he was terrified of the police department," Toro said. According to Toro's lawsuit, Tempe police officer Jeffrey Gebby told Bicking's to swim to a pylon. When Bicking's said he couldn't, Gebby responded by saying, "Okay, I'm not jumping in after you." Bicking's began yelling for help and said that he couldn't touch his feet to the bottom. When it became clear that the police would not save him, he called out for Smith. She tried to jump in to save him, but Officer Kelly Bennett restrained her, and Gebby handcuffed her. At 5:16 a.m., 4 minutes after he entered the lake, Bicking's went under the water. Police did not recover his body until nearly 6 hours later. According to the lawsuit, the police report noted that Tempe has a police boat, but that it requires two people to operate. For that reason, it took some time for it to arrive, by which point Vikings had drowned. At 5:41 a.m., the police report noted that the boat's operators were not able to get around a barrier in the water. Tempe enlisted the Scottsdale Police Department to review the incident. The administrative review found that officers acted correctly and should not have entered the lake to save Vikings. Demanding more. Donovan Lewis befriended Vikings while both were unhoused on the streets of Tempe, though Lewis has since found housing and helps those who lack it. Vikings' death and the circumstances that led to it still wound him. The whole situation could have been avoided, in my eyes, if the police officer would have actually done something instead of turning around and saying, "I'm not jumping in to save you," Lewis said. "That hurt me. Seriously. You're supposed to be serving and protecting. Why not serve him?" Toro's lawsuit notes that just 11 days before Bicking's death, Tempe police officers helped rescue a dog from the Tempe Canal. Those officers were willing to confront that risk for a dog on May 17, 2022, the suit reads. But on May 28, 2022, the involved defendant, Tempe police officers, did not even walk to the bank of the Tempe Town Lake while a human being drowned to death in front of them. In addition to stronger safety measures, Toro would like to see Tempe make more efforts to help the homeless, including by addressing the warrant issue Bickings had confronted. She said city officials were ultimately unwilling to work with unhoused people to let them meet where they were comfortable to resolve warrants. At that time, it became apparent that nothing was going to be done, Toro said. "I was given false promises to appease me, and that is the reason I am here today." Baxter Ging said the city has had open hours at Tempe Municipal Court for warrant resolution, and that it participates in the Maricopa County Regional Homeless Court. It's unclear if those efforts began before or after Bicking's death. Baxter Ging did not respond to a question seeking clarification. Still, Toro noted that she and others recommended meeting with unhoused people where they felt comfortable, at shelters that provide food, and have come to be trusted by an unhoused community that is deeply skeptical of law enforcement and city officials. "I would like to ask the city of Tempe to ask themselves, what if you or a family member were in the situation some of the homeless communities are in today?" Toro said. "Would you not do everything you could to make sure they had what they needed, or at least the best you could?" Phoenix School District didn't inform parents of sexual abuse settlement. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on May 29th. Since the beginning of the year, Phoenix Elementary School District No. 1 has been mired in turmoil. In March, the school board angered some parents by voting to close two schools and end a lease with ASU Preparatory Academy. Not long after, Phoenix New Times reported that school board president Jessica Bueno had bailed out a former business associate who'd been caught and later convicted in an underage sex sting. Weeks after that, in the face of vociferous parent backlash, Bueno resigned. Two of those angry parents were Allison Gullick and Paul Booth, whose four-year-old son attends preschool at Faith North Elementary in the district, and whose youngest child will start at Shaw Montessori School in the fall. Since the beginning of the year, they've spoken at school board meetings and dived into public records to learn everything they can about the embattled school district. They even created a pamphlet chock full of information about the schools the board voted to close. It was amid her public records research that Gulick learned something alarming. The district had paid $200,000 to settle a lawsuit brought by a former student over sexual abuse she experienced at the hands of her math teacher. The lawsuit wasn't news. It had been filed in 2023, and the teacher in question had already been tried and convicted in criminal court. That the district had settled the suit wasn't even the issue. For Gulick, the problem was that she'd had to dig to even find out about it. The school district hadn't said a word to parents about it, and the settlement never appeared on the school board meeting agenda. According to a district spokesperson, the school board never even discussed it in executive session. Gulick and other parents felt kept in the dark. The complete disregard for even mentioning that was going on shows the district's repeated lack of transparency that they have with parents, Gulick said. Bueno's position remains vacant, and many district parents who pushed to oust her hope that a more transparent school board president will take her place. Gulick has thrown her hat in the ring for the job, submitting an interest form to Maricopa County Superintendent Shelley Boggs, who will select a new board member. Then, the board will vote to determine who serves as president. School safety should be a foundational value, Gulick said. We need leadership that supports the victims and stops ignoring violence that's happening in the schools and holds people accountable. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hobrock.